Recording in progress.
Okay, I had a little internet problem, but I think I'm all set. And today's webinar, I have a special guest with me, Dr. Mark Bailey from New Zealand. And I've done a interview podcast with him, so I'm pretty sure everybody knows who Mark is. So I don't really like to do introductions anyway, because I can't remember where you went to school and I don't really care anyway. So today is Friday, July 15th. Thanks for joining me. And today we're just going to focus on this viral challenge or proposal that we came up with. I say we because there was a bunch of us involved, but I guess you could say Mark and I were two of the masterminds of this. I'm happy to take credit for it if it doesn't work. So whatever is fine with me. So I thought we would just describe it. And before I'm going to let Mark describe the details of what we're proposing in this, and where you can find it to read it, I wanted to put this in a little bit of a context, which is to say, how does a scientist, or actually, I would almost say, how does a human being go about proving something A exists and B causes something? Because that's really what we're talking about here. Because we're the whole point of this challenge is to question whether it's been proven that these, quote, viruses exist and that they're pathogens, meaning they cause disease. Now, for most people in the real world, it's generally not that difficult. So if I said, do you believe or do you know that a chair exists and that you can sit on it, or that when you sit down, the chair causes you not to fall, we do something very simple, which is we sort of look below, and if there's this structure that meets the definition of a chair, we say, yep, we're pretty sure that chair exists. And then you do something, which is to sit on it. You know, you put your butt down on this structure and you see if it holds you up. Now, I would just point out that when we talk about isolating variables and isolating factors, you don't prove that a chair will hold you up by sitting on a chair and a stool and a couch and a sofa and your bed all at the same time. You could do that and it might hold you up, but we all understand that that's not proving that it was the chair that did that. And my point here is it's not actually that unusual thinking of how to go about proving something exists and causes something else. Now, some people have said, well, but that's not a living example. It's not an example from biology. Biology is more complicated. And just off the top of my head, I'm thinking, so if you want to prove that a frog exists and can eat flies, I think frogs eat flies, you would go and find a frog, not a frog and a snake and a raccoon and a cat, and then maybe put a bunch of flies in and see if the frog does it. And you would have isolated the frog and investigated whether the cause of the demise of the fly was only the frog, not the frog and the cat and the snake and the raccoon, et cetera. People just wouldn't do that. Now, let's take, those are sort of macroscopic examples. So, but I would just point out that if you come to examples which are, say, sub-macroscopic, in other words, microscopic, it does get trickier because you can't see it, or sometimes you maybe can't feel it or hear it. And you still might want to investigate whether it's the cause of something else. A exists, B the cause. So you really have to do the same process. It's the same rational, logical thinking process. But here, because you have to do things other than your normal senses, and I can't emphasize this enough, you have to be sure that everything, every procedure you use to see it or hear it or feel it doesn't change what you're seeing or feeling or hearing. That is crucial. And that's something that seems to have been forgotten by basically every scientist in the last 50 years, besides Harold Hillman, who said, you can't use electron microscopy or ligand studies or a whole lot of the things which are standard procedure unless you prove that they don't affect the existence or the quality or what you're seeing and what the cause of whatever phenomena you're looking at. You have to validate that. And the way you validate that is by doing controls. And that's what he proposed and was sort of hated for that because he poked holes in pretty much every standard, microscopic subcellular biology mechanism because they didn't do adequate controls and they were creating artifacts. Now, let me just give you another example of that, which is a tricky one. And it's what I would say controversial. So according to Hillman, he questions whether synapses in nerves actually exist. I've been over this many times. Synapse nerves have a break and then they have a presynaptic vesicles, which we're told have these chemicals called neurotransmitters. And they get secreted and cross the synapse, which is like a moat. And then it attaches to the postsynaptic vesicle. And that's how a nerve is conducted. And I've said for years now that that's way too slow. Now, Hillman wrote most of a book just saying that those synapses are artifacts of the dehydration, drying of the tissue, which creates separation of these nerves, and that you never would see a synapse, a gap in a living nerve. And now that could be because it's too small to see. So you have to be careful with that. But he wanted to make sure that if you claim that you see a synapse, that the technique that you used did not actually create it or create the chemical staining on either side in these vesicles, and so they weren't really there. Now, here's, for me, one of the fundamental reasons of this challenge. In order for somebody to prove that there are synapses, for me, and I probably this is the same with Mark, they better know how synapses were found in biological experiments. Similarly, it's not too different than if you're going to talk about how to make whether bread is real, you better know the process of making bread. So unless you know the process of finding a synapse, my opinion of this is you have no say in this debate. You have to know how it was found in order to actually have a valid opinion. Now, here's the trouble when you apply this to the virus thing. So we ask people, our colleagues, other members in the health freedom community, what makes you think? Why do you even criticize us about the existence of a virus? And they say things like, how do you explain gain-of-function studies? Or how do you explain that my Aunt Bessie got sick? The problem with that is that's not how virologists find viruses. And the problem really is, my guess is, those people actually don't know how you find viruses. Show that they exist and prove that they cause disease. It's like when I've asked people, other doctors and scientists, how do you know there are synapses and neurotransmitters? They say things like, well, I gave a patient Prozac and they got better. In other words, giving somebody a chemical, they say, that increases serotonin, they say, and makes somebody feel differently, they say that proves the existence of synapses. But it's obvious that's not the case. You can give somebody cocaine and they'll feel differently, and that doesn't prove their synapses, or that cocaine was is found in your nerves intact. Or they'll say, well, I saw an electron microscope picture of it. And you say, well, how did they get that picture? And they don't know. Which means, but when you find out how you actually got that picture, most people don't believe that it's actually depicting something in real life. In other words, it's an artifact. Now, I'm not saying that proves there are or aren't synapses. What I'm saying is, in order to have a seat at this table, it's important for everybody involved to know how they came up with this. And for me, that's the basis of this challenge. We have decided, I think, and Mark can correct me if I'm wrong here, that we are going to test how the virologists have decided to prove the existence of a virus and show that it caused disease, because we think it's irrational, illogical, and anti-scientific. And if that's the case, there's no basis for, you know, thinking that SARS-CoV-2 exists, causes COVID, all the lockdown measures, all the masking, all the injections, all the antivirals, they go out the window because there's nothing to treat. And so to me, that's it's to get this on a solid scientific footing. Let's be clear. How do they prove it? How do they prove it exists? How do they prove it's a pathogen? Let's test that. That is the debate that we all need, not verbal sparring, which seems to get nowhere. So with that, I'd love to hear from Mark as to any comments on that. And actually, what are we going to test here?
All right. Well, thanks, Tom. That's a pretty hard act to follow, but I'll do my best. As Tom says, he was the brains behind this proposal for the statement of the virus challenge. And myself and Kevin Corbett then took the document, the skeleton that Tom provided us, and worked through to create a two-page, fairly concise document covering what we wanted to cover. Now, we had a whole lot of other signatories who have also contributed. And we've got a couple of other signatories who haven't added their names just yet, but in a few hours, we'll have them on the list as well, just in case they were wondering why they were missing. But essentially, as Tom says, the viral theory is very specific, and the virus has two main characteristics, really. One is the physical characteristics, in which it's a physical particle. It has to have a physical existence, being a proteinaceous type coat containing a genome. And the other main characteristic of it are the biological ones. So the particle has to be replication competent. It has to be able to infect a target or host cell and create more copies of itself and then go on to infect other cells. So that's a very specific theory. And as Tom's pointing out, we can't look at other things like epidemiology or antibodies or PCR tests or people getting sick, because all of those things can happen without the viral theory. So it's not enough just to look at these indirect things and claim that's evidence of a virus. Now, if we look at what the virologists were trying to do for much of last century, they were actually trying to do the methodologies that we would suggest are required for the definitive proof or at least solid evidence that there is an existence of viruses. So in our statement, we've outlined the steps that would need to be taken. Now, these are not steps we're proposing for the actual settling virus debate document, but if ultimately the experiments required would be of the following. Step one, a unique particle with the characteristics of a virus would need to be purified directly from the tissues or fluid of a sick being. And we're not worried about how this purification is done. Often it's done with centrifugation, but it could be filtration or other methods. We'd suggest that at this stage, electron microscopy could be used just to confirm that the particles are all identical to each other and purified. Step two would involve the particles, the purified particles, being biochemically characterized, looking at their proteins and the genetic sequences. Step three would be confirmation that the proteins are proven to be coded for by the same genetic sequences that were detected. Step four would involve the purified particles alone, and this is important because this is not the typical experiments we see, but the purified particles by themselves would need to be shown through a natural exposure route to cause sickness, an identical type of sickness in test subjects by using valid controls. And finally, step five, the particles would then have to be re-isolated, and that means purified again from the test subjects at the previous step, and then demonstrated that these particles have exactly the same characteristics as the particles we started with in step one. So we realize though that this is not going to happen, and probably because, well, we suspect all attempts to do so have failed, and we've certainly seen no publication in the history of virology which would prove that those steps have been achieved. So what we've proposed instead with our statement here is meeting the virologists halfway. And as Tom said, we'll look at how they do things with their own techniques to prove that viruses exist. So step one, we propose that we'd involve five virology labs around the world, but none of them would know the identities of each other. And we'd obviously have to have a monitor appointed at each lab to independently supervise all the steps. We propose that each of the five labs would receive nasopharyngeal samples, so nasal swabs, from four different categories of people. And that would be a total of 20 swabs each that would be sent to each lab. And the four groups would be, the first group would be people who do not have any medical condition currently. The second group would be people who have had a diagnosis of lung cancer, a current diagnosis. The third group would be people who have had a diagnosis of influenza A. And the fourth group would be those who have had a diagnosis of the alleged COVID-19 disease. Now, obviously, we'd have to agree on how these are diagnosed. We're not saying that the PCR is valid for diagnosing things like influenza or COVID-19, but for the purposes of this challenge, we would accept that. So what would happen at that stage is all of the 20 samples would arrive at the lab. The lab would be blinded to the nature of the samples, and then each lab would try and isolate any viruses that are potentially inside each of these samples. We'd get them to do their typical cell cultures, looking for the so-called cytopathic effect, which the virologists use as the evidence of isolation or the presence of viruses according to their own theory. We'd also ask them to do control experiments with so-called mock infections. But in this case, because of the problems we've seen with a lot of the design of their mock infections, we'd want that to be fully disclosed in detail. Each lab would then get electron microscopy images of their samples to show whether or not the cytopathic effect is present or otherwise. And again, that would be done by an independent electron microscopist. And at that point, we'd collate all that data and proceed to step two of the challenge. So all of the samples would then be sent for genomic sequencing. And once again, each lab would be blind to the nature of the samples that they are receiving. We'd ask them to then see if they can detect the alleged SARS-CoV-2 genome in each of the samples. And we'd expect the samples who have had the diagnosis of COVID-19, we expect them to find the SARS-CoV-2 genome inside those samples. And if it was COVID-19 wasn't diagnosed, we would expect them not to find the SARS-CoV-2 genome. And importantly too, because each lab would be receiving the same samples from patients who are alleged to have COVID-19, we'd actually expect them to find identical sequences since they're coming from the same person. So that's sort of like an overview of the challenge that we propose. Now, obviously, that's not the full protocol. And we have people available like Stefano Scoglio and Mike Donio who have agreed to help us design the experiments if the virologists agreed to do so. And if we were successful, or if the virologists were successful with this first round of experiments, then we would request that they proceed with the purification experiments, which is the ones I outlined first, because at that point, I think we'd have far more definitive proof that the viral theory was correct. So that's sort of an overview of the statement. We'll have the statement up on different websites from each of the signatories, plus the source document will be hosted on my wife Sam's website at drsambailey.com. So, yeah, Tom, that's an overview of things. And is there anything else we need to discuss?
Yeah, the only other thing is we actually do have a pledge of a fair amount of money to financially support this. So that shouldn't be the issue. I believe we can say that if there are virology labs who want to participate, I don't know that we've actually figured out how we're going to find them yet, but they should probably contact Mark or myself. And that's, I think, fairly easy to do. You know, Mark, it's an interesting thing. This, because we're sending the same sample of, you know, lung cancer or influenza or supposedly COVID, the same nasopharyngeal sample to all five labs, they should get identical genomes, right? I mean, unless there's some theory out there that you who have COVID have more than one type of SARS organism or SARS-CoV-2 organism. In other words, you have your own variants, which I don't know that I've ever heard that. You certainly, that's not what doctors or health people are currently telling people. They say you have the Omicron variant, you have the Delta variant, you have the original type or whatever. So they're suggesting that every unique person has a variation or the, you know, some example of this virus. Each virus should have the same genome. Every lab should therefore sequence the identical genome. Same with influenza A. They, if it's one person, it's not 10 different people having 10 influenza A's, which I don't think they even suggest exists. They should all have identical genomes. If they don't, they have to explain how that's how that came about.
Yeah, definitely. And as you know, we're not saying that the detection of these genomic sequences is a valid way to prove that the viral theory is correct. What we are saying is we just want to test them on their own techniques that they're currently using, because one of the things that we've found, and this has been revealed by a lot of Christine Massey's Freedom of Information requests, is that the labs don't tend to do any control experiments where they simply take a sample from someone said not to have one of these diseases and then see what they can sequence. Instead, they're doing controls with what we would say invalid controls, because they're not taking human-derived samples and then seeing what sequences they can find in those as well. And I know we've certainly asked some of the labs whether they would be able to do these experiments, and they pretty much obfuscate their answers and direct us to protocols which show negative control experiments involving simply adding water or culture media, which of course is insufficient to test the theory, because the control should have everything in it apart from the alleged virus. And right. As we know, if you're not adding a human sample, then that's not the type of mock infection that's being used. So yeah, essentially, I think we know too, and some people will probably be asking when they see the statement why Stefan Lanker's name is missing from it. And we definitely had dialogue with Stefan about the statement. Stefan's position is that virology has already been refuted, so this is an unnecessary step that we're taking here. And Tom, you can probably speak more about this too, because you've had more dialogue with Stefan, but he also feels that last year when he conducted the control experiments, he was able to see the cytopathic effect without adding any possible viruses. He was simply adding things like yeast RNA. And he also demonstrated that with PCR amplification, he was able to generate the SARS-CoV-2 genome in a control experiment without, again, possibly adding any viral sample. So yeah, people are wondering why Stefan's not involved with this one. It's not because he he has too much of a problem with it. He just thinks that we've already shown that the viral theory is not correct. But Tom, you might have
something more to add about that. Yeah, I mean, that's basically it. And he doesn't. And you know, this was specifically designed to, in a sense, to bring together the health freedom community. That was a major interest in mine, so we can actually work together, not fight each other, and also specifically to not give like what I would think are silly reasons why we believe, or some of them believe, in these viruses. Like, well, my Aunt Bessie got sick, or how do you explain gain of function, or, you know, everybody believes it, so do I. And it's very hard for me to understand why we wouldn't want to test this. And so for good or not, I mean, I know I can be criticized for this. I decided to let's meet them a little bit halfway here, right? As a first step. Okay, let's do your technique, even though the technique is obviously not the right technique. The technique that Mark laid out is the same technique, and it's doable. It's show the existence of something directly from a sample, purify it, which is, as far as I know, never been done. Put that in a cell culture or an animal if you want. Put everything else besides the virus in, see what happens. They don't want to do that. So we're going to meet them halfway. I think it's a very, it's a gesture of bringing the movement together. And I really hope that the people in this movement see it like that. And so they really all get behind it. And then we can have hopefully a joint news conference and say they can't do it. We're now have the ammunition to, because we get told, well, you'll never win this in court. Well, here it is. And then, you know, I've had lawyer friends tell me, if you can prove that the basic supposition of this whole event is invalid, everything else goes out the window. And that's the end of it. And we're not going to go through monkeypox and bozo pox and all the rest of the poxes that were in the World Health Organization, I think just yesterday announced we have to go back to the masks and the lockdown because there's a new BA, I think they should call it BS variant. We don't need to do that. And if we don't get this right now, this is an opportunity for humanity. And we're trying to get it right.
Yeah, Tom, I think something really interesting, and as you say, one of the purposes of the statement was to invite other members of the health freedom movement to get involved with what we're doing. And as you know, we've had some feedback, which has been really interesting so far. Some people very supportive of the statement and others not so supportive. But what is most interesting is that nobody has really denied the importance of doing the actual experiments. People have had problems perhaps with the way some of the sentences are worded regarding what exactly purification is, or some of the statements we've made about the history of virology. But that's all unimportant when we're dealing with the actual scientific method here. And as far as I'm aware, Tom, I certainly haven't had any feedback that there's a problem with the actual experiments themselves, because the procedures we've outlined are actually what they do every day around the world. The only difference is that we're saying, let's do them, but we'll blind the labs to the samples they're getting so they don't know in advance. And essentially, we'll have some really good control experiments, which is at the heart of the scientific method, because what we've really seen with virology and what a lot of us are concerned about is that it's essentially just a descriptive pursuit at the moment, where various phenomena are being observed and a story is being told about what this means. So that's fine when you're at the initial stages of investigating something, but we're well past that point now with virology. And if they've got theories, then they need to put the hypothesis forward and we need to test it. Basically, we need to be extremely skeptical that that's the right theory. And we need to create falsifiable experiments that can be carried out. And that's simply what we are suggesting here.
Yeah.
And I know many of us are trying to point this out that, and I know Jordan Grant's done some good presentations on this in the last year or two, that we cop flack that we're not following science or that we're pseudoscientists, etc. But in fact, it's the complete opposite. We're just saying, let's bring it back to the scientific method where we do tests, which just involve altering one variable at the time, and see what kind of results we get. And I think our protocol outlines it pretty clearly. But keep in mind too, we're not making some sort of claim that this is a definitive statement or document. We are just trying to get to a better solution, because at the moment, the claims being made by virology are turning the world on its head, basically. And many of us feel that there's absolutely no basis to this, that the procedures and the policy responses are not only wrong, but they're incredibly destructive to humanity and are causing far more harm than good. And for most of us involved in this movement, we just don't see any benefit coming out of what they do. So we have something here which could be carried out at a fraction of the cost. It certainly wouldn't take long to do. And the world would have an answer whether these virologist techniques are valid at all. And I think, as we said earlier, I think Stefan Lenk has produced the evidence that these techniques are not valid. And when he produced his experiments, it was disappointing that some other labs around the world didn't say, holy cow, we better check this out, because it looks like there's a real problem with the techniques we're using.
Yeah. And just to finish here, maybe that we're not asking people who become signatories that they agree that there's no virus. They're only agreeing to find out. And that's a big difference. Like, I don't want to end up at the end of my life saying, I can live with the fact that I don't know a lot of things, because I already know that's true. But I can't live with the fact that I didn't want to find out, especially if it's important. I can live with I don't know the answer. I can't live with somebody said, well, you could find out like this, and I said no. I just don't want to live with that. The other thing, as you pointed out, Mark, we're not hearing, well, no, you should do the experiment like this. This will give you a better result. We would love to hear that. Like, no, you have to do 7 blinded at that because the chi-square only works with 7. Fine, we'll do 7, maybe. That's not what you hear. You hear it'll never work in court. It's divisive. It's whatever. That's not the case. Let's just do science, get it over with, move on. We can have a much better life. All right, Mark, I think we got it. So can you just tell people where to view this document?
Yeah, sure. Well, as I say, it'll be hosted on Dr. Sam Bailey's website. That's where we're going to keep the source document, the original PDF. Just give me a couple of hours here to get a couple of names on who have added their support, including Mike Eden, which was really good. So once people see, Tom, you'll put up the PDF as well on your website. If people have a look at the signatories, many of the names are going to be familiar to them, and many of them have their own websites. So we've asked all of the participants who have been involved in developing the document to put the PDF up on their website as well. So yeah, and everyone can feel free to pass it around and spread the word.
Yeah, get your family doctor to sign it or to contact us, and we'd be happy to explain how this all works.
Yeah, and as Tom was saying, we're really happy if we've made some sort of mistake with our overall design. And keep in mind, it's just an outline. It's not a full protocol for the experiments, but we'd certainly be keen to hear back from any virologist or microbiologist or any other scientists who think that there's a way we could improve the design, because I'm sure, like everyone, they'd be really happy to show whether these techniques are valid or not.
Yeah. Okay. Thanks, Mark.
And, thanks, Tom.
We'll move on and see what happens here. And we'll keep everybody posted. Sam, I'm sure you and Sam will, and we will. And we'll give regular updates. All right. Thank you. Thanks, everybody, for listening, and have a great weekend.